And recently, he saw it firsthand. The glances, the subtle comments, the references to those guys over there. Was this kind of thing normal? Or was it a cause for concern? More important, if it did turn out to be the latter, what could actually be done to remedy the situation? How could peace be found during an invisible war? Elevator dings, arrive on floor, speak broken Japanese, wait, and wait, and wait some more. Then someone came over to let him know the meeting had been canceled. Apologies, smiles, let's reschedule, then more waiting, more flying, and more hours spent not sleeping through the night on his way back to London, or France, or Brazil. Is this a joke? Kalinske asked as Nilsson paced around his office. No, Tom, I'm very serious, Nilsson replied. I wasn't actively looking for something else, but the more I think about Viacom's offer, the more sense it's beginning to make. Viacom's offer, as it turned out, was actually three offers. He could choose between vice president of Viacom's new media division, vice president of consumer products marketing for Nickelodeon, or a hybrid job to oscillate between the two, with some MTV work thrown in from time to time. The main takeaway was that Viacom was flexible. They didn't care exactly what Nilsson did as long as he was doing it for them. Are you feeling unappreciated? Kalinske asked. Is that it? Me? No, not at all. I don't need a pat on the back whenever I come up with a good idea. It's not like that. Then tell me what it's really like. I'm trying, Tom, Nilsson replied, taking a deep breath. It's a combination of things, really, but it starts with all the traveling. But you love to travel! I thought so too, but not like this. Nobody could like to travel like this. You're right, Kalinske said. And I imagine it can't be good for your health. Exactly, Nilsson replied. And you know I can't sleep on planes. That's right, Kalinske said. Well then, why don't we take a closer look at your schedule and see where we can cut? It's not just the travel, Nilsson said, shaking his head. It's also the job itself. Kalinske knew that Nilsson wasn't thrilled with the job, but he hadn't quite realized the level of his dissatisfaction. What is it about the job that you don't like? Is it something specific that maybe we can fix, or just a general feeling? Nilsson stopped pacing and took a seat. This was a good question, one he hadn't asked himself nearly enough. Everything had blurred together to such an extent that he'd stopped taking notice of the difference between specifics and generalizations. Well, a lot of times, Nilsson began, thinking back on his least favorite meetings, most of the time I just feel like I'll go in, and then what happens is, he said, then trailing off. At that moment, he realized that this wasn't about specifics or generalizations, but actually about influence. And when he played it all over in his head, he realized that he had none. I'm like a diplomat without a country. What do you mean? Kalinske asked. I'm heading this group and traveling around the world, but nobody I speak with actually has to listen to me, Nilsson said, figuring this all out as he spoke. I'm supposed to be the head of global marketing, but when I go to Sega of Europe, I'm just an employee from SOA. And when I go to Sega of Japan, I'm just an employee of SOA. And then the worst part is that when I finally do come back here, they look at me like I'm no longer part of SOA. Kalinske didn't know what to say. This wasn't the first conversation they'd had about Nilsson's frustrations, but it was the first that made him think it was more than just Nilsson venting about jet lag. Still, as bad as it all sounded, he knew that Nilsson could never leave Sega. He was Sega. How could he go somewhere else? And especially now when the company was poised to finally surpass Nintendo. I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree with any of it, Kalinske said. These are all extremely valid concerns, and hearing what you're going through gives me an even deeper appreciation for everything that you've accomplished this past year. What have I accomplished? Nilsson asked. Kalinske laughed, thinking this was a joke. Turned out it wasn't. Oh, Al, don't get down on yourself like that. Sega is on the precipice of something big, and you're the one holding everyone together. Nilsson sighed. Maybe. But I don't know how much more of this I can take. Can you just give it a little bit more time? Klinsky asked. I don't think so, Nilsson said, surprising both of them with that response.
So what are you saying? Klinsky asked.
I don't know, Nilsson replied. But it has to mean something that I haven't told Viacom no yet, right?
It does, Klinsky said.
It means you need to take a step back and figure out what's really important to you. So while you're doing that, why don't I see what can be done to ease your burden?
All right, Nilsson said, standing up.
Thanks for listening.
Always, Al, Klinsky replied.
I mean it. Always. Nilsson walked toward the door, but before leaving, he turned around with one more question. I just realized that in all this talk about me, I forgot to ask how you were doing. So, how are you doing?
Don't worry about me, Klinsky advised. Things are going great.
Although this was likely the same answer that Tom Klinsky would have given even if the sky were falling, things at Sega really were going great. The Genesis and SNES were neck and neck. Game Gear was about to catch up to Nintendo's Game Boy, and Sega CD, Sega Channel, and development on Sonic 3 were all great examples of the company's continued commitment to reaching the next level. For the time being, Sega was firing on all cylinders, but it was the future that had Klinsky concerned. Particularly when it came to a next-generation console. After Sega and Sony had spent nearly 6 months trying to jointly develop 32-bit hardware, it appeared that they couldn't come to an agreement on the system's architecture, and the entire thing fell apart. What it boiled down to was that Sony's Ken Kutaragi wanted to create a machine that was 100% dedicated to 3D graphics, whereas Sega's Hideki Sato wanted to build a machine that could also accommodate the typical 2D sprite-based gaming. This didn't make any sense to Klinsky. Weren't three dimensions undoubtedly better than two? Hadn't Sega CD proven that players craved lifelike graphics? What was the issue here? But when Klinsky pressed for an answer, he was told that this was better because developers would have a very difficult time making games in 3D. And when Klinsky requested more information beyond that, he was told in a variety of ways that he wasn't an engineer and simply could not understand. Just like that, the future that Klinsky had envisioned was now nothing more than a what-if buried in the sands of time. And the worst part was that Sony planned to continue with its 3D system and enter the console market on its own, creating a whole other foe for Sega to contend with besides Nintendo. No, forget it. That wasn't even the worst part. Not only would Sony be entering the console market on their own, but they now had the advantage of knowing exactly what Sega had up its sleeve. Wait, scratch that as well, because there was something even worse. What Sega had up its sleeve was not very good at all.
In a word, Joe Miller said, looking at a prototype of the system.
It's lousy.
How lousy? Klinsky asked, feeling his stomach sink.
SOJ had recently sent Shinobu Toyota a prototype of this new 32-bit system, which they were calling the Saturn. And when it arrived, he and Klinsky naturally brought it to Joe Miller, SOA's resident tech expert.
I can't say for sure at this point, Miller explained. I mean, all I'm looking at is hardware here, chips and processors. But it's much less sophisticated than I would have expected. Whether or not it will run smoother than what Sony has planned, who knows? That will depend on a lot of factors. And good software has a proclivity for making tech problems disappear. But instead of trying to finish the sentence, Miller just slowly shook his head. Thank you, SOJ, Klinsky sarcastically thought over and over, and he would continue to sporadically shake his head in frustration until he realized there was still time to fix this. At the earliest, the Saturn wouldn't launch until 1995, which meant that there was still an opportunity to salvage the situation. SOJ didn't want to work with Sony? Fine. Then Klinsky would find someone they would be willing to work with. As it turned out, it was Doug Glenn who actually found the right match. Silicon Graphics, SGI. They were one of Silicon Valley's top manufacturers of high-performance hardware and software, most famous for inventing those magical computer systems that Hollywood used to make its most elaborate special effects, like in Jurassic Park and Terminator 2. Apparently, they had developed a revolutionary new chip that would propel the video game industry forward, and they were looking for a partner.
This is fantastic, Kalinske exclaimed, giving Glenn a giant mental hug. SGI had a reputation that had to be taken seriously, but not the consumer electronics track record or the perceived arrogance, to rub Sega of Japan the wrong way. To see if this possible match was really as good as it sounded, Kalinske went with Miller and Glenn to SGI's headquarters in Mountain View, California. There they had an incredible meeting with Jim Clark, the founder of Silicon Graphics, and Ed McCracken, the company's president. The chipset they had developed was apparently quite something.
"It's going to be far more powerful than anything out there in the market today," Clark proclaimed. "I guarantee it."
"Wow," Kalinske said. "I have to say, this all just sounds incredible."
"The next logical step in gaming," Miller added. "Why don't you show them the demo?" Glenn suggested.
"You already got something to show us?" Kalinske asked.
"Phew, you guys sure do know how to impress a guest."
"Just wait until you see what it can do,"
Clark said as the demo started.
And he was right. Kalinske was completely and utterly blown away. He hadn't felt this way since seeing the Genesis for the first time. And boy, oh boy, was it good to feel this way again. Kalinske wasn't the only one checking out new technologies. Tony Harmon was traveling around Europe in his search for the right company to make his great game. There was so much impressive work being done at a variety of places. But Harmon didn't find what he was looking for until arriving in Leicestershire, England, where he met with a company called Rare. Although each software company is fundamentally unique, Rare Ltd. had managed to rise above the pack and live up to the inherent boast behind their name. From corporate history to creative vision, they really were a rarity. That's why in the 80s they were the only British developer chosen to ride Nintendo's wave, and it's also why, come the 90s, Rare had seemingly fallen off the face of the earth. It all started with the Stamper brothers, Tim and Chris. In 1982, after years of programming games for various arcade companies, the Stampers opened their own shop and started making games for the Sinclair ZX Spectrum. From a creative perspective, developing for the Spectrum made complete sense. At the time, it was the most sophisticated, fastest-processing personal computer available in the UK. But from a business perspective, it was a little bit dicey. Less than 1 million people actually owned the computer. Nevertheless, the Stampers were committed to making the best games for the best system available, so that's exactly what they did. And in 1983, they released their first game, Jetpack, which amazingly went on to sell more than 300,000 copies. In a medium where players rarely gave a second thought to who made the games they played, Tim and Chris Stamper were the exception. Most of this fanfare could be attributed to consistently releasing hits, like Pst, Trans Am, and Cookie. But a small part stemmed from the brothers' seemingly reclusive behavior. The Stampers rarely gave interviews, never attended developer conferences, and generally showed no interest in coming out from behind the curtain and taking a bow. Were they really as shy as this reputation made them out to be? Probably not. But it also didn't really matter because they were much more interested in making games than talking about making them. The Stampers believed that the quality of a game directly correlated to how much time was spent making it, which is why they famously worked 18-hour days, 7-day weeks, and 364-day years. They took off Christmas. Given this incredible work ethic, fans anticipated great games for many years to come. But the Stampers shocked the industry in 1985 when they sold their publishing label and suddenly stopped making games. They must have burned out, their fans rationalized. After 3 years and only 3 days off, the Stampers must have gone just a little bit insane. That was the only logical explanation, and that theory certainly made a lot of sense. Except that it was the complete opposite of what had actually happened. The Stampers weren't burned out. No, they were actually more fired up than ever. It's just that they were no longer lit by the Sinclair ZX Spectrum, but rather by a Japanese console called the Family Computer. 1 year earlier, Tim and Chris Stamper had gotten a hold of Nintendo's 8-bit system, and were immediately convinced that this represented the future of video games. The only problem with this new interest was that, at the time, Nintendo didn't grant licenses to developers outside of Japan. Since the Stampers were incapable of suddenly becoming Japanese, they decided to do the next best thing. Reverse-engineer the console, teach themselves how to make games for this system, and then travel to Kyoto and convince Nintendo that they were worthy. They did all of this under a subdivision of their company, codenamed Rare.
Not long afterward, they visited Nintendo, and were not only granted a license to make games, but given an unrestricted one that enabled them to release as many as they wanted. In 1987, they made two games for Nintendo. And in 1988, they made four. In 1989, that total shot up to 16, and by 1990, with 18 games, they were making more than any other developer. This much productivity and this many quality games had been enormously profitable for both companies. Naturally, Nintendo assumed this relationship would continue for many years to come. But when they launched the SNES, the Stampers appeared to have little interest in programming for Nintendo's new 16-bit system. And similar to what had happened in 1985, the Stampers appeared to have mysteriously lost interest in the video game market. This time they must have burned out for real, right? What other explanation could there be? But, like before, there was a good explanation. And when Tony Harmon learned it, he was absolutely stunned. All he saw was about 10 frames of a three-dimensional boxer, but it was enough to do the trick. The smoothness of the gaming environment, how quickly it rendered in real time, it was incredible. This was it. This was the one. But the boxer had to go. To make a great game, they would need an iconic character. So, they either had to start creating one from scratch, or see if Miyamoto might be in a giving mood. Chapter 51. The Last and Best of the Peter Pans. It was a bright, breezy day in June. One of those warm, bronze afternoons where the sun makes you squint just enough to take notice from time to time. It was that kind of day, but even if it hadn't been, that's how Al Nilsen would have remembered it. Because that's just the kind of weather that goes perfectly with bittersweet memories. "I can't believe you're really leaving us," Fernassier exclaimed, shaking her head. Neither could Nilsen. It was all happening so fast, but it felt like events were moving in slow motion. How was that even possible? When would it stop feeling this way? And why hadn't someone descended from the heavens to put a stop to all this? "Me neither," Nilsen said. "But I guess it's time to move on." They were standing on the patio of the Sofitel, joined by dozens of Sega veterans waiting for their chance to say goodbye. About 20 feet in front of them was the black-blue lagoon of Redwood Shores, which added a sense of tranquility to the moment that turned most of the day's sadness into a soft, reflective optimism. "Look at what we did together. Look at how we took ideas, or even pieces of ideas, and just went ahead and banged them into all sorts of crazy things. That was us. We did that. And there will be even greater things ahead. Best of luck, I mean it. And you better stay in touch."
"You did a damn fine job," Paul Ryo said, sternly shaking Nilsen's hand.
"It just will not be the same," Shinobu Toyota said, patting his back. "Viacom's lucky to have you," Ed Volkwine said with a grin.
Nilsen had accepted a job as Viacom's vice president of strategic marketing. In this role, he would still have one foot in the video game industry, supervising the marketing plans for games based on properties from Nickelodeon, MTV, Paramount, and Showtime. And he'd have the other foot in the entertainment industry, expanding Nickelodeon's licensing business. Most important, however, he'd have both feet on the ground and not 10,000 feet up in the air. "Leaving is one thing," Ellenbeth Van Buskirk said, looking as vibrant as ever. "But did you really have to go all the way to New York? You know that's not really walking distance from here, don't you?" "But," Nilsen began and then stopped. It took him a second to summon the right tone. "But," he said jovially now, "it looks so close on the map." In truth, that was the worst part about the new job. Well, that and having to sport a fake smile or get into a mini-argument with anyone who said he was so lucky to be moving to New York. He didn't like New York. So many people, so much impatience in the streets. Van Buskirk shook her head. "Is this maybe just another one of your elaborate and unexpected master plans? I'm standing here knowing that I'm supposed to say goodbye, but I keep looking up, half expecting to see a plane skywriting something like, 'Just joking.'" "Well, E.B.," Nilsen replied, "I think that's a very valid concern. So if I were you, I just would never bother with a goodbye. I can live with that. How's Bob?" "Great," Van Buskirk said with a faint blush.
primarily referring to her budding relationship with the handsome and argumentative business consultant she'd met at the airport 4 months earlier. It was always nice to see people who deserved to be happy actually feeling that way, Nilsson thought. And strangely enough, this was a rare sight. After Van Buskirk, there were several others. Richard Burns, Michael Latham, Deb Hart, and all the others who had helped the company grow from a question to the answer. From Sega to Sega! Seeing the parade of faces would occasionally take him to the brink of sadness. But every time he started to feel that way, there would be some small reminder that things were no longer the same. Shrugs of complacency, salary complaints, grumbles that certain people didn't know the difference between marketing and simply spending money. A few people even hugged him goodbye, and then whispered in his ear that they'd be leaving soon too, that they were just waiting to get their bonus before moving on. "Al, Al, Al," Kalinske said, walking over with that dapper smile. "I finally figured it out."
"Figured what out?"
Kalinske looked over his shoulder as if about to reveal a precious secret.
"Figured out why you're really leaving," he said in a half-whisper.
"Oh yeah?" Nilsson asked. "Can you tell me, because I'm not so sure anymore?"
"I have to admit," Kalinske said, "that was tough to piece together. You're not the type of person who would bolt for more money, and you're not the type of person who is impressed by climbing the corporate ladder."
"True," Nilsson admitted, "but I do sometimes love visualizing an actual corporate ladder and imagining men going up and down it in fancy suits and ties."
That's exactly the type of comment that helped me arrive at the answer.
"Which is?"
"I don't know how many years ago it happened, though. It couldn't have been all that long ago. You were just a little boy. A regular child about yay high," Kalinske said, holding a hand right above his waist. "And for whatever reason, a girl, a job, a hedgehog, you made a wish, just like Tom Hanks in that movie Big. The next morning, voila, you woke up, and you were an adult. So all these years, people have been calling you things like a big kid or boy trapped in a man's body, and you must have just been laughing so hard, knowing it was the truth."
Kalinske nodded, evidently proud of his theory.
"But eventually, just like in the movie, there comes a time when you need to return to just being a kid. And I guess that time is now. So I just want to let you know that your secret is safe with me. Okay?"
Nilsson wagged his head up and down. He would miss Tom most of all. Well, after Sonic, of course. But it would be close.
"Just remember," Kalinske said, "it's never too late to change your mind and come back."
Nilsson nodded, even though it wasn't really true. The place had changed, and that's why he had to go. After his recent conversation with Kalinske about the difficulties of his new job, there had been a few changes, but it just hadn't been enough. And at first, this had made him upset, at himself, at Kalinske, and at anyone standing in front of him at that moment. But then eventually he realized that it was nobody's fault. There was no change that could be made to his job that would put the puzzle back together. Things were just different. And as he stood by the lagoon and listened to Kalinske proudly talk about his wife, his kids, and everything that Sega had planned, Nilsson was overcome by a thrust of sadness. The feeling was sharp, and it was deep. But he couldn't figure out if he was feeling this way because the magic that had made this place so damn special was now all but gone, or if it was because hardly anybody else had realized it yet.
Part 5. The Tortoise and the Hare. Chapter 52. Next Gen. Three men stood at a podium, each one bursting with a palpable sense of pride. To the right was Ed McCracken, the president of Silicon Graphics. Dressed in a brown suit and tan tie, he appeared somewhat uncomfortable in the spotlight. But beneath his uneven smile was a pristine confidence, confirming that this announcement was really as revolutionary as those in attendance had suspected.
"It's great to be able to work with the industry leader," McCracken said, before going on to describe his new partner as one of the best marketing companies in any industry.
To the left was Jim Clark, the founder of Silicon Graphics,
Although he looked like an adult version of Charlie Brown, this man was no peanut. He knew how to control a room, use smiles as effectively as pauses, and describe big, complex things as if they made all the sense in the world. "We're going to integrate graphics, computing technology, software, compression, and encryption. All of the technologies needed to make all of this happen. And we're going to put it all on one chip." And between these two men, representing one of the world's largest video game companies, was a calm, confident, steely-eyed executive, Howard Lincoln. "I'm here this morning to announce the next generation in Nintendo Home Entertainment products," Lincoln said. "A product whose improved gameplay will, simply put, be stunning. Nintendo, together with Silicon Graphics and MIPS Technologies, subsidiary of SGI, have entered into a worldwide joint development and licensing agreement under which our companies will develop this new and unique product." To demonstrate the gaming power of this proposed new product, a splashy video showed off 3D graphics of a shuttle hurtling through space, a jet jittering through Paris, and a race car revving its way through a speedway. "It will utilize the real-time 3D graphics technology for which Silicon Graphics is world-famous," Lincoln boasted, "and will feature a new true 64-bit MIPS multimedia chipset. All of this will be combined with Nintendo's unequaled expertise in video game creation, technology, and marketing. A full quantum step of game performance," McCracken added. "And it's going to be far more powerful than anything out there in the market today," Clark added as well. "Far more powerful. I guarantee it." Although it's easy for executives to boast about having the best thing ever, the 3D demo was proof that this was about more than just words. The graphics on display weren't quite lifelike, as there was an obvious animated quality to them. But the shapes, colors, and movements were closer to reality than anything that had ever come before. Perhaps then, it should come as no surprise that this new console, scheduled for release in 1995, would soon be named Project Reality. But for now, this revolutionary system had no name, nor did it even need one. The only names that really mattered were Silicon Graphics, Nintendo, and not Sega. A couple months earlier, Tom Kalinske stared at the phone on his desk, hoping that something might miraculously change between now and when he dialed the number. But after realizing that hope was no substitute for acceptance, he finally picked up the phone. "Is Jim in?" Kalinske asked when Jim Clark's secretary picked up. When she went to look for her boss, the founder of Silicon Graphics, Kalinske fought off the urge to go over exactly what he would say. Normally, preparation was a good thing, but here would only make him sound rehearsed, and that was the last thing Kalinske wanted. He wanted Clark to hear the raw nerves in his voice, for whatever that might be worth. "Hey, Tom," Clark said, sounding aloof but upbeat as he often did. "What's going on? Have you come with good news?" Raw, honest, aggravated. "Sadly, the opposite." "What do you mean?" "I've just heard back from Japan," Kalinske said with a muted growl in his voice. "And the response, well, it's very disappointing." After the meeting with Silicon Graphics, Kalinske had been over the moon about the idea of forging forward together. To convince Sega of Japan that this was the right move, he worked with Toyota, Miller, and Glenn to present the case for SGI. It had many of the same benefits of working with Sony, but would still give SOJ the autonomy they desired. They probably wouldn't love the idea of working with an American company, but there was no denying that what Silicon Graphics could build would be more powerful than anything being developed in Japan, including the Hitachi chipset that was currently in place to power the Saturn. And that SGI's chipset would undoubtedly be cheaper. It was a no-brainer, a guarantee that Sega would be a major player in the next generation, but SOJ didn't see it that way. They had called Kalinske earlier today to notify him that they were not interested in working with SGI. "What? Why?" "The chip is too big." "Huh?" "It's too big." "Too big for what?" "Sorry, no thank you. Goodbye." "Tom," Clark said, sounding shocked.
I know very little about what your R&D team has planned, only what Joe Miller shared with me, but I can all but guarantee you that our chipset is going to be faster, more powerful, and cheaper than what they have.
I know, Kalinske said. I'd be surprised if you weren't correct about that.
All right, Clark said after a pause. All right. No, it's not all right, Kalinske replied. And I apologize for wasting your time.
All right, Clark repeated.
What am I supposed to do now?
Good question. And one that Kalinske had recently began to ask himself about his own future. With Sega of Japan's rejection of deals with Sony and now Silicon Graphics, Kalinske had seriously begun to doubt that this fairy tale would have a happy ending. He thought seriously about resigning, but he just couldn't deal with the thought of abandoning his team. If SOJ planned to slowly dismantle SOA, then the least he could do was stay here to fight alongside Ryo, Toyota, Vernassier, Glenn, Miller, and everyone else he'd sold on his vision.
Jim, here's what I'm going to do, Kalinske said, now skimming through his Rolodex. I think I have the name of someone who might be very interested in hearing about what SGI has to offer. Kalinske scrolled past the beginning of the alphabet, slowing down as he approached the letter L.
Do you have a pen ready?
He kept skimming until he got to the contact information he was searching for. Lincoln Howard. Chapter 53. Man's Best Friend. Like a lifelong bachelor looking at photographs of his ex-girlfriend's wedding, Tom Kalinske couldn't fully believe that the marriage between Nintendo and Silicon Graphics had taken place, except for the fact that it had made all the sense in the world.
How could this happen? Kalinske asked.
But he didn't expect a reply, nor did he receive one. Although there wasn't really a suitable answer to the question, in this case the lack of response was due to the fact that Kalinske was speaking to his dog, a frisky Airedale named Chutney, who over the past few months had come to redefine the meaning and importance of the phrase, man's best friend. Long nights at the office and even more travel than usual had slowly distanced Kalinske from his family. They were still priority number one, and he continued to make the time for soccer matches and school plays. But as the constant hustle at work weighed on him more and more, he could feel the emotional connection eroding ever so slightly. Or maybe that was all in his head. Maybe the girls were just getting older, and didn't see their old man as the knight anymore, and maybe Karen was just exhausted from raising another child. Whatever the case, Chutney continued to be a source of stability in a house full of change, and these late-night walks were a great source of maintaining his sanity, giving him a chance to bask in unconditional affection and soliloquize without feeling self-conscious.
The thing is, Kalinske mused to his beautiful Airedale, everyone is so happy. Their spirits are flying so high. You should see the smiles around the office. But I can see what's bubbling beneath the surface, and it's no good, Chutney. No good at all.
Although Sega was experiencing its best year ever, the company's long-term prospects were looking rather bleak. Not just because of the failed partnerships with Sony and SGI, but more so because Kalinske felt that his ability to lead had been neutered, and for no good reason at all. At Mattel, like most companies, corporate politics was a big part of the job, but at least there he felt like he knew what his political rivals wanted. He may not have agreed, but he knew where they stood, and could even respect their point of view. But here? What was it that Sega of Japan was looking to accomplish? Did they simply want to cut off their nose to spite their face? And where did Nakayama stand in all of this? From everything Fisher had reported, it appeared that Nakayama supported Kalinske, so was this invisible coup so strong that not even the force of Nakayama-san could stop it? Chutney suddenly started scratching at a patch of grass, and then playfully rolling around on it. It was nice to see that uninhibited joy, and feel like at least someone was capable of seizing the moment. Kalinske knew that was what he needed to do. Seize the moment, that is, not roll around in the grass. And mentally prepared himself to accept everything that had already happened, and focus on that which he could control. Sega was having another great year, and there would be a lot of good things coming in the months ahead.
Mortal Kombat in September, the Thanksgiving Day Parade in November, at which the gigantic Sonic balloon would make its debut, and likely another Christmas to besting Nintendo. This time, however, they needed to do more than just outsell their competitor. Sega needed to build a big enough lead to create some kind of a cushion for the inevitable fall. And as Chutney rolled around the yard, occasionally silhouetted by the silvery moonlight, those famous words from Mortal Kombat echoed in Kalinske's head. Finish him. Like most 9-year-old boys alive in the fall of 1993, Chris Anderson couldn't help but slowly lean forward on the couch whenever an ad for Mortal Kombat came on the television. It was a pretty normal commercial, no special effects or anything like that, but there was just something about it. Probably it was the shouting. There was a whole lot of that. The whole commercial, really, was just all these kids running really fast around New York City and shouting, Mortal Kombat! On second thought, shouting wasn't really the right word. Chanting was more like it. They were chanting it in their toughest tough guy voice, like the one everyone uses when they're sitting in the back of the bus. And they just kept saying it over and over as the kids took over the city. And the coolest part about Mortal Kombat, besides the special moves, the crazy fatalities, and all that stuff, was that the game would be coming out on Sega and Nintendo. Usually the games only came out for one system, or came out first on one of them, but Mortal Kombat was going to be on both Genesis and SNES. So, depending on which version was better, it seemed like there would finally be an end to the shouting matches about Sega and Nintendo. Mortal Kombat was going to be the best game ever, so the best version of the best game ever would settle this once and for all. Finally. That Mortal Kombat ad was usually enough to rev up someone's afternoon, but today, Chris Anderson was in for a double feature. Shortly after the one for MK, they also played one of Sega's newest commercials. This one wasn't for any particular game, but instead it was a comparison between Game Boy and Game Gear. But it wasn't just like, this one does this and that one does that. It really hammered home the point. It started off in black and white, with the camera going back and forth between both of the handhelds. And then, just when you started to notice the noise of a dog breathing loud, the announcer came in and said, "If you were colorblind and had an IQ less than 12, then you wouldn't care which portable you had." Right after that, the camera switched to color, and they showed that the whole time, it was actually a dog who was looking at the Game Boy and the Game Gear. And then when the dog was trying to tell the difference between the portable systems, the announcer came back to say, "Of course, you wouldn't care if you drank from the toilet either." Try hearing that for the first time and not falling over laughing. Either way, between the two commercials, it was enough to make any boy wonder, would Santa Claus be unemployed if it weren't for Sega and Nintendo? Dog slurping water out of the toilet? It's a terrible stereotype, don't you think? Peter Mayne asked, but like Tom Kalinske earlier, he didn't receive a reply, nor did he expect one. It was a chilly autumn morning, somewhere between 6 and 7 o'clock, and Mayne was on his morning walk with Casey, a striking 100-plus-pound black Labrador that he had purchased back at a Boys and Girls Club auction in 1991. This was how he began each day, and was also what helped him get through the hard ones. Without these walks, without these 45 minutes to pal around with Casey through the neighborhood's topsy-turvy hills, he'd have been a different type of man entirely. Angrier, crankier, and unable to let go of the things that made him want to punch the wall. He needed these 45 minutes to regroup, rejuvenate, and remember what this game of life was all about. It was about winning, winning some more, and making sure to have a ball. But it took these morning walks to remind him that accomplishing that often required taking the long view. That meant no shortcuts, no impulsive responses, and no trading away tomorrows for today's. "How about another lap?" Mayne asked, leading his beloved canine up the verdant incline. He wasn't a patient man by nature, but he had become that way through discipline, and these walks served as his daily reminder about the importance of this virtue. And they'd become particularly invaluable as Sega continued to test Peter Mayne's patience. Whether it was pricing, advertising, or those curious numbers that Tom Kalinske pulled out of his ass, it was always something with those guys. For the most part, this was a good thing. It upped the ante, and kept Mayne and his colleagues on their toes. When Nintendo had 90% of the market, that had been a damn fine time, and very much deserved. but there's a reason that kids fantasize about coming up to bat with two strikes in the bottom of the ninth. A hero needs his moment, and Sega had set the stage for Nintendo. But keeping with the baseball analogy, Canadians may prefer hockey metaphors, but by now Maine had taught himself to look, walk, and talk like an American, Sega had started throwing spitballs. The Mario vs. Sonic stuff? Fine, that was kind of clever. So were those first few next-level ads. They didn't make much sense, but they were cool, and that was the point. But this latest nonsense about drinking out of the toilet? That just crossed the line. Sega wanted to come after Nintendo? Fine. Compare products, compare prices, even compare the two companies' images. But don't just lob grenades and run away giggling. Perhaps if Maine had known that the commercial in question was actually titled Tom's Dog, and that his rival at Sega adored an Airedale named Chutney as much as he loved his Labrador Casey, he might have realized that the two men had more in common than not. Under different circumstances, perhaps they could have been friends. But as it turned out, that was not in the cards. They were destined to stand on opposite sides of the aisle, each gradually defining himself by what the other was not, and each likely gaining more from the other in opposition than they ever would have in friendship. "You all right, girl?" Maine asked after Casey flinched away from the patch of flowers she had been investigating. "Casey?" She briefly looked back at him, and then returned to snooping through the flowers. As she did, Maine saw what he imagined was the reason for her reaction. A bee loitering over her shoulder. It must have buzzed past her ears, stirred her a bit. Maine thought about shooing the little noisemaker away, but Casey seemed fine now, and that was good enough for him. It was almost time to head back home anyhow. The morning was about patience and playing the long-term game. It was about dropping yesterday's baggage and heading into the office with open arms. Yesterday, when he'd seen that stupid ad with the dog, he'd been tempted to respond with fire and fury. But as much as he'd wanted to do so, he'd known that the time wasn't right. Getting involved in a pissing match would end up weakening Nintendo as much as it did Sega. It would cost a lot of money and, more important, cause Nintendo to lose focus on the consumer. The better play was to stand back and let Sega tire themselves out. The ads would surely only get more outrageous, and their tech-obsessed mindset would inevitably lead them to introduce more products than they could possibly support. And then, when Kalinske was busy juggling 50 mediocre things at once, and Nintendo had its next top-grade product ready to launch, the world would see that there's no amount of B's, C's, and D's that can ever add up to an A+. In other words, the bee can buzz all at once, but if it ain't carrying any honey, then that sucker is best left ignored. "Time to head home," Maine said to Casey. "But don't you worry, girl. We've got a standing date set for tomorrow." Chapter 54. Night Trapped. "Mortal Kombat?" Bill Anderson asked his son. "What's that?"
"It's the best game ever," Chris Anderson replied very matter-of-factly.
They were in the kitchen, having a family dinner, and Anderson looked to his wife to see if she might have any idea what in the world their son was talking about.
"It's a video game," she said. "He talks about it all the time." "Because it's the best game ever," Chris Anderson repeated. "And it shows why Sega crushes Nintendo."
Mortal Monday had come and gone, and as Kalinske had hoped, Sega annihilated Nintendo. Mortal Kombat on the Genesis outsold the SNES version, and in the process, Sega had finally, impossibly, and amazingly surpassed Nintendo. They now had 55% of the market, but more important than the numbers were conversations like these, where 9-year-olds were convinced that Sega was now king. Anderson nodded. He liked the idea of buying his son a video game. Decades ago, he used to really enjoy playing in the arcades, and he finally remembered when his wife had first introduced him to Atari's home version of Pong.
"Okay,
I'll look into it." In the coming days, Anderson looked into this Mortal Kombat and was appalled by what he found. It's not as if he expected it to be anything like Pong, but this game was just incredibly inappropriate. The violence, the blood, the glorification of cruelty. And Mortal Kombat was just the first clue about what was really going on with video games. There was one called Street Fighter, and another called Streets of Rage, and those weren't nearly as bad as the newest ones coming out on CD, like Night Trap and Sewer Shark. After this brief personal journey into the world that his son apparently adored, Anderson decided to share these findings with his boss, Senator Joseph Lieberman, a Democrat from Connecticut. As it turned out, Lieberman was just as appalled as Anderson, his chief of staff, who went on to explain that in addition to this horrific Mortal Kombat, there were plenty of other similar games out there. "Look, Senator," Anderson reasoned, "I realize that some people might call our reaction here prudish, but that's not really the point. These games are becoming more and more like movies, and I can't help but wonder if parents have any idea what they're buying for their kids." This conversation and their mutual concern led Lieberman and Anderson to delve further into the matter. Although they weren't the only ones in Washington sniffing around this issue, they quickly became the most serious about getting the government involved. But before taking any action, they needed to better understand what exactly was going on. And to do so, they looked to the top of the industry and found the two companies most responsible for what was going on, Sega and Nintendo. Perrin Kaplan, who had worked on Capitol Hill prior to joining Nintendo, still had contacts in D.C., and was informed about what was going on. This was much more than Arthur Pober talking about whispers. These were distinct conversations going on in the shadows. And this made Kaplan intent on educating Senator Lieberman about what Nintendo did. So she invited him to come visit Redmond. Kaplan expertly worked to assuage any doubts he had about making the trip west, and any lingering concerns were likely erased by Senator Slade Gorton of Washington, who had worked with Nintendo on the Mariners deal and was also a close friend of Senator Lieberman. Once the plans were made, Lieberman and members of his staff visited NOA headquarters and got a crash course on Nintendo and the kinds of games that the company produced. Kaplan talked about how Nintendo had resurrected the industry through meticulous quality control, how NOA vigorously vetted and sometimes censored its games to ensure a wholesome quality, and how Mortal Kombat was a great example of the difference between Nintendo and its primary competitor. This was not a slight on Sega, but merely the facts, and Senator Lieberman appreciated the information enough to roll up his sleeves, pick up a controller, and spend some time trying out the Super Nintendo. After returning to D.C., Senator Lieberman gave the issue further consideration. On November 17, 1993, he distributed the following letter to members of Congress. "Dear colleague, a woman is stalked in her home, mutilated and murdered. A man is instructed to finish his opponent in a martial arts contest and chooses to rip his opponent still beating hard out of her body. These examples may sound like shocking cases stemming from the current epidemic of violence plaguing the United States. In fact, they are witnessed by children every day. Worse, children participate, since these examples are drawn from some of the most popular and most disturbing of a new generation of video games. Gone are the days when video games were just Pac-Man and other quaint characters. Advances in technology permit the latest video games to use real actors and actresses to depict murder, mutilation, and disfigurement in an extremely graphic manner. And the technology is rapidly becoming ever more realistic. Today's graphic games may seem mild compared to the CD-ROM and virtual reality systems, which will change the market very soon. These games will come right into our living rooms if a pilot cable channel for video games slated to begin next January proves successful. At a time when real violence is threatening to tear the fabric of our country, these games glorify the most depraved acts of cruelty. While parents across the country are trying to teach their children to abhor violence, these games encourage children to enjoy violence. The Washington Post recently quoted a 14-year-old boy on the appeal of one particularly disturbing video game. It's violent. It's real. You can freeze the guy, cut him up, shoot him with a hook that is a rope so you can pull him. I like the moves and stuff. The video game industry has not addressed the danger presented by their latest creations. In fact, some have made violence a selling point. One game was introduced to great fanfare on Mortal Monday. Currently, parents have a very difficult time knowing which video games are slightly violent and which are truly repugnant. No uniform system exists for warning a concerned parent about the violent content of a video game which she is buying for her child. I plan to introduce legislation and hold a hearing on this topic. The legislation will create the National Independent Council for Entertainment and Video Devices, NICEVID, which would oversee a two-stage response to the threat of joystick violence. The first stage is a one-year window in which the council will encourage and work with the video game industry to address the problem through voluntary means. If the industry fails to take credible steps within that one-year period, the council will be charged with mandating what type of information concerning the contents of a video game should be available when a person buys a video game. At that time, the council will have the authority to consider a variety of responses, including establishing a mandatory rating system, warning labels explaining the content of the product, or point-of-sale warnings. Today, more than a third of all American households have video game systems. Almost two-thirds of children between the ages of 6 and 14 play video games. Parents deserve to know what they are buying for their children. If you would like to co-sponsor this legislation, please contact me or have your staff contact Sloan Walker of the Subcommittee on Regulation and Government Regulation at 224-3993. Sincerely, Joseph I. Lieberman. As Kalinske read these words, a brittle numbness set in. All the darkest thoughts he'd had over the past 2 years, those moments of doubt about himself, Sega, or the video game business at large, were being held up to a mirror the size of the Washington Monument. His toy industry days really were behind him. The man who had once empowered children to imaginatively become masters of the universe would now be seen as a peddler of smut, the drug pusher who gets children hooked. The first one's free, kiddies. That's why we put Sonic in the box. Wait a minute, no. Those are just the doubts creeping in again. A variant on the universal doubts that all humans are prone to have when the sky blocks out the stars. Am I worthy of success? Am I the beneficiary of luck, misconceptions, and the work of others? Have I been a good husband, father, and friend? The letter on Kalinske's desk preyed upon his worst fears. But Senator Lieberman's words didn't magically turn doubts into facts. Well, here were the facts. 80% of Sega's players were older than 12 years old. Sega was the first and only company to institute a rating system, which had successfully been in place since July. Over 90% of the titles released for Sega's system were rated GA for general audiences. Sega worked with Scholastic, the teacher-trusted publisher, to create a widely distributed brochure aimed at educating parents about video games. On Sega's own initiative, it established a charitable foundation targeted at giving our youth a better society. In only 2 years, the foundation had already raised $4.3 million. If Sega was guilty, then so was Nintendo. After considering this last fact, Kalinske decided to write a letter to Nintendo of America's man behind the curtain, and on November 22, 1993, he sent the following. Dear Mr. Arakawa, though we have never had the occasion to meet, I believe recent developments merit this attempt to open a dialogue with you. As you know, our companies embrace different approaches to handling fighting games and adult-appropriate interactive entertainment. I think the time has come for a comprehensive industry-wide approach to the issue of informing consumers about our products so they can make intelligent purchase decisions. In short, I think it is necessary for our nascent industry to grapple with, and for you and I to proactively lead, that industry to a uniform, responsible solution to this issue, one of which we can all be proud. As the leading companies in the video game category of the larger interactive media and entertainment industry, you and I can forge a bond of personal commitment to doing what is right for all involved, ensuring free choice and enabling people to control what comes into their own homes. I am urging you in the strongest possible way and with the greatest respect to join us at Sega and the scores of independent software companies who make software for both Nintendo's and Sega's hardware platforms in adopting the Sega rating system administered by the Independent Video Game Rating Council, VRC, which is composed of highly respected PhDs from a variety of disciplines, or to adopt some other similar rating systems and to communicate it on your new products. You know, as do I, that your company creates and or permits marketing of software titles for your game systems that portray a level of violence as great as anything in the industry. In fact, the PhDs of education, childhood development, psychology, and sociology on our own VRC tell us any game where the objective is to demolish enemies through martial arts or weapons should be designated for an audience over 13 years of age, no matter if animated blood is included or not. Nintendo's game development guidelines are an inadequate way, one, to ensure consumers' freedom of choice, two, to enable consumers to gain enough information that would allow them to exert control over the types of software titles brought into their homes, and three, to guarantee they are always appropriate for the age of the user in that home. I know you must appreciate that your guidelines were probably appropriate for this business when it was less sophisticated, and when over three-quarters of the user base was under 17 years old, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Now, when our technology is so much more sophisticated and increasingly attractive to adult audiences, it seems to me an industry-wide rating system is the type of responsible self-regulation you and your company should join us in adopting. I am sure that we could find sponsors in our government's legislative branch who would assist us in getting an antitrust exemption to collaborate on this matter if that is a concern that is inhibiting your positive response to this entreaty. Mr. Arakawa, I ask you to please, with an open mind, consider this suggestion, and to consider the benefit we all gain by doing the right thing for the consumers, adults, and children who have been so generous in rewarding both our companies with such great success during the last decade. Attached is additional information on the Sega rating system. Sincerely, Thomas J. Kalinske. One thought that raced through Howard Lincoln's mind as he read through Tom Kalinske's letter. Boo-hoo. If it weren't for Sega, none of this would be happening. You don't get to stand on the shoulders of Nintendo while trying to climb up the mountain and then ask Nintendo for help when it's time to climb back down. Boo-hoo. That said it all. But it didn't make for a particularly tactful response. Nor did shredding Kalinske's letter into confetti and sending it back to Sega. Following Senator Lieberman's call to action, strong support in Washington had led to a series of Senate subcommittee hearings slated to begin on December 9th. Lincoln would be attending the hearings on behalf of Nintendo, and Kalinske would likely be there to represent Sega. Lincoln and Arakawa believed that the hearings would be the appropriate time to reply to the issues voiced in Kalinske's letter, and so they opted to focus on preparing for that and not waste time becoming Sega's new pen pal. Although they didn't write back to Kalinske, there was a Nintendo mailing that indirectly amounted to something of a reply, one that accomplished the take-that sensation of a confetti party, but remained elegant and tactful while also serving a purpose. When the drama had first started to unfold in Washington, D.C., Perrin Kaplan had made a VHS tape containing the most graphic scenes from Sega's Night Trap, a graphic grisly game that was unlike anything Nintendo would ever offer to its customers. And to demonstrate the difference between the two companies, Kaplan arranged for several hundred copies of these tapes to be sent to representatives in Washington prior to the hearings. If the video game industry was about to be sent in front of a firing squad, then she wanted to at least make sure the riflemen knew where they should be aiming. Chapter 55. It's just windy, not a metaphor. At 48 feet tall and 26 feet wide, Sonic the Hedgehog soared through the sky. Swiftly and serenely, Sega's beloved mascot made his way through the chaos of Manhattan. The newest larger-than-life balloon in Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade through a deal struck by Tom Abramson. "Where is he?" Ashley Kalinske asked from the window of a building downtown. "Yeah," Nicole Kalinske added, eager to see her dad's friend Sonic. "He's coming," Tom Kalinske told his daughters, "and he can't wait to see you. But in the meantime, don't forget to stuff your faces with food." Behind the window, in the room full of retailers, merchandisers, and other friends of Sega, was a wonderful buffet that added an exclamation mark to the occasion. It had been a hectic past few weeks, what with preparing for the Senate hearings and the media storm that would inevitably follow, but Thanksgiving offered a nice chance to take a step back and enjoy Sega's success with his family. Kalinske had flown out to New York with his wife and kids a day earlier, enjoyed a quick romp around the Big Apple, and ended the day by taking his girls over to Central Park West, where they got to see the balloons being blown up outside the Museum of Natural History.
Is that him?
Nicole asked, ignoring the table full of cookies.
No, it's just Clifford the Big Red Dog, Ashley said, disappointed.
Kalinske put his arms around the girls and was about to remind them not to worry, but at that moment he was informed that there was an urgent phone call from Brenda Lynch that required his attention. He excused himself and walked over to the reception area to take the call. Is everything okay? He asked.